soon as I pulled in my driveway and I was overtaken by a chemical smell, immediately my chest started burning. I felt like I couldn't breathe. My lips were tingling, throat burning, eyes watering. I didn't need a scientist to tell me that things weren't okay.
It's absolutely a moral responsibility for all people of conscience, for the labor movement, for social movements as a whole in the United States, to continue pushing and pressuring our own government from stopping its direct support for the state of Israel's extreme policies.
I heard somebody say that some union rep who was didn't approve of our times very much was saying that there's a red under every bed at our times. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I guess that's partially true.
But well, we're about 408,000 members actually right now, and that's our record here since we were created in 1896 and been around for a long time. So we're at record levels and want to keep that going.
I was not in my office, burst through my doors, and my secretary said, "You have a student crouching underneath your desk." I just want to warn you when you go on.
You're listening to the Labor Radio Podcast, weekly produced by the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org. I'm Chris Garlock. On today's show, a report from East Palestine. The UAW's Brandon Mancilla talks about why peace is a labor issue. What's next for Canadian labor journalism? IUOE Legislative and Political Director Seth Toth discusses the Biden administration and offshore wind energy in Humboldt County. And in our final segment, Jessica Breidinger, a social science instructor at Treasure Valley Community College in Ontario, Oregon, talks about the rural community college experience. This week's featured shows are Work Week Radio, which broadcasts Thursdays on San Francisco's KPOO 89.5 FM, The Valley Labor Report, a weekly talk radio show airing Saturdays at WVNN 92.5 FM in Huntsville, Alabama, and Sundays on WGOL 920 AM in Russellville, Alabama, Radio Labor, the global news service, Breaking Ground, the podcast from operating engineers Local 3 in the Western U.S., and OEA Grow, the weekly podcast from the Oregon Education Association. Hey, before we get to the show, now you can wear your support for the Labor Radio Podcast Network. That's right, we have snazzy t-shirts with the cool network logo hot off the press from our friends at Works Printing, a worker-owned union cooperative. You can check them out, laborradionetwork.org. That's all ahead in this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here is the show.
This is KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM and KPOO.com on the internet. This is Work Week with Steve Zeltzer. The continuing struggle to get health care for the residents of workers in East Palestine, Ohio, continues 1 year after the massive railway derailment and the release of massive amounts of vinyl chloride. The community and workers are now having massive health problems, and their health care is running out. A panel was organized after the visit of President Biden to the community to discuss what is needed now. Next speaker is Jamie Ray Wallace. She's with East Palestine Unity Council president, and also she is a past union activist in the SEIU and other unions, and has been fighting to mobilize the community and labor. So welcome, Jamie.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for creating this awareness. As Steve said, my name is Jamie Wallace. I was an executive board member of SEIU 1199 for 10 years while I worked at Cleveland State University. So I decided to move back to East Palestine, Ohio in 2018. I honestly thought that, you know, I would retire from Cleveland State University. I had tried to have a child my entire life, was never blessed with a child. And at 42, I found out that I was going to be having my first child. My first thought was, I want to go home. I have 47 immediate family members that live within the 1 mile of the derailment that happened last year on February 3rd of 2023. I wanted that family support, you know, to be able to have my niece to stop by and pick up their little cousin to go to the park, or, you know, have that luxury of family watching my child while I worked. Kind of like Chris says, up until the derailment, I was living my happiest life. I was going to work, I was coming home and enjoying time with my family, time in nature. You know, my life has changed so drastically since then. Right away, the EPA was telling people it was safe to return home. My husband and I even had kind of a little argument. He said, what are we going to do when they lift this evacuation? I said, well, we're going to go home. If the EPA says it's okay, it's okay. I pulled in my driveway the next day to grab some prescriptions. As soon as I pulled in my driveway and I was overtaken by a chemical smell, immediately my chest started burning. I felt like I couldn't breathe. My lips were tingling, throat burning, eyes watering. I didn't need a scientist to tell me that things weren't okay. My own body and my gut told me that things were not okay. I quickly started organizing, trying to get true answers. And I actually started the Unity Council for the East Palestine Train Derailment because I couldn't handle all this on my own. You know, you almost needed a couple of full-time people just to watch what the EPA was doing, just to watch what our politicians were doing, to watch what Norfolk Southern was doing, to deal with people with mental health issues. You know, there were just relapse. People were relapsing from drug and alcohol addiction. All of our issues come down to, you know, them trying to save on costs. The workers in East Palestine were exposed to chemicals. Norfolk Southern did not want them wearing PPE because it gave the appearance that something was wrong. OSHA came in and helped those workers. But if you look at the industrial jobs across the country, 4 days ago, my niece's husband passed, 31 years old. He had liver cancer. And it didn't hit me until I read his obituary that ever since he was 18 years old, he had been working at the same place and it was a supervisor. It was a plastic factory. Never before would I have thought twice about seeing that. But the first thing I thought was, could he have possibly been exposed to something? When you look at the working class people, these young men, young women that they're putting into these positions, they're doing it because they have families to take care of. My stepdad, now 60 years old, union bricklayer his whole life, they used to walk in and take asbestos out of places with no PPE. But he was also making $60 an hour and had a family to feed. We shouldn't have to sacrifice our lives to make a living in the United States of America. This is not just an issue with East Palestine. This is a systemic issue. This could happen tomorrow in any one of your backyards, and you would be treated the same way that we're being treated. We're being ignored. Our health issues are being ignored. And I feel like the only way East Palestine is going to get help is awareness with the people, because I refuse to believe that any human being would be okay with children having bloody noses, children having seizures, you know, rashes. I don't think anybody can look at this in East Palestine and say this is okay. So I appreciate you for creating this awareness today and allowing me to speak.
You're listening to Alabama's only union talk radio show, The Valley Labor Report, with Adam Keller and Jacob Morrison.
That's right, folks. From the mountains of Kentucky to the bayous of Louisiana, broadcasting online and on the radio from the heart of the Tennessee Valley, the Spice Radio Studio in Huntsville, Alabama. This is the Valley Labor Report. My name is Jacob Morrison, here with my co-host and fellow agitator, Adam Keller. We're going to continue a theme of internationalism by bringing on Brandon Mancia, UAW Region 9A director, that is up in the Northeast, about the UAW's call for a ceasefire in Gaza. Brandon, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Great to have you. Big fan of what you're doing up there, and appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. So, you know, just I think one thing that may be worth it may be worth starting the conversation with just explaining to people what is happening in Gaza.
What's happening right now in Palestine and Israel is absolutely a tragedy. Since October 7th, there have been over 30,000, as that we know of, Palestinians that have been killed in Israel's retaliatory bombing campaign in Gaza. As of right now, over 1 million people are at risk of famine because humanitarian aid cannot enter Gaza because Israel is blocking the aid coming in. And it's, in my opinion, a deliberate policy of starving out the Palestinian people. And it's a genocide that Israel is now carrying out and using October 7th as the reason to carry out this policy. All of this is being done with support of the U.S. government through the weapons and the political backing, even though, you know, the reports now there's some tension between the Biden administration and the Secretary of State and Netanyahu's government. Even though that may be true, it's not enough that from keeping the U.S. from continuing to support Israel's campaign right now. So not enough has happened yet to actually challenge that status quo. But I think what it's really important to figure out is that October 7th was not the beginning of this crisis. We're talking about a long history here of oppression, of dispossession, of apartheid that has created the conditions for what is happening right now. So it's absolutely a moral responsibility for all people of conscience, for the labor movement, for social movements as a whole in the United States to continue pushing and pressuring our own government, because that's what we can control. Our people, the American people, can pressure our government from stopping its direct support for the state of Israel's extreme policies and its campaign against the Palestinian people right now.
This is a Radio Labor Canada report recorded on Friday, March 22nd, 2024. I'm Marc Boulanger. After 42 years, the highly respected Canadian labor magazine Our Times is closing. The magazine started as a project by Italian workers in Toronto as a way to publicize their issues and support the Canadian labor movement. It was such a good idea that the magazine soon expanded beyond its roots to become a professional journal publishing high-quality labor journalism. At first regarded with suspicion by the country's unions, red baiting 42 years ago was still rampant, Our Times became adopted by the labor movement as its magazine, its outlet for good labor journalism, which addressed the real issues of real working people. Over the years, it was guided by people such as Lorraine Endicott.
I realized when I was preparing for this panel that Our Times was actually first published 42 years ago this month, on March 1982. I just thought that's pretty amazing. 42 years ago, the magazine started out as an Italian-Canadian journal, and it was founded by young first-generation Italian-Canadians, Katie Pellizzari and Frank Lento, and their friends, and published out of an office above a cafe on St. Clair Avenue in Toronto. Over the years, the magazine, with core support from the Toronto and York Region Labor Council, was transformed into a full-blown independent labor magazine. There's piles of history before that and in between, but I'll just say our mission has always been to publish stories promoting workers' rights and social justice. And our hope was always that Our Times would be used by the labor movement and its allies as a tool for education and for action, as an organizing tool. So here's what my take on what made Our Times unique and valuable. Two things come to mind. One was the magazine's independence, and the other was how the magazine fit in to the labor movement amongst all the other labor media at the time, and how unions used Our Times. So as far as our independence goes, it was always sort of a double-edged sword, because in my experience, Our Times' journalistic independence has been a fundamental strength of the magazine. You know, it was us, the editors, the workers, the designers, with our board as backup, that we could decide which stories to accept or to seek out and which ones to put on the cover. Union leaders didn't get to vet the stories or tell us what we could or couldn't publish, even though they were funding us as a group, but they had to trust us. And believe me, that's not a small mission, getting unions who are very divided amongst themselves within the labor movement to trust the same magazine that's publishing stories from all these different workplaces and union-based memberships. Anyhow, that trust took years to build. When I first came to our times, I heard somebody say that some union rep who was not approval, didn't approve of our times very much, was saying that there's a red under every bed at our times. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I guess that's partially true. But basically what we wanted to do was publish workers' stories about workers' rights and social justice. So I don't know what's worse, being ignored, being smeared, or getting on with the job. That's so while we've always largely depended on donations from unions, of course, and everybody else, but we were never dependent on just one union for support. And this lack of one big source of revenue protected our integrity as a publisher and our ability to bring up difficult issues at times, issues the labor movement didn't necessarily deal with well, or sometimes at all, such as sexism and racism within the movement, just for example. The environmental issues and the climate crisis is another example of issues, especially earlier on, but the labor movement just wasn't dealing with and making the connection with workers' health and safety and the environment. We were free to highlight what could be considered difficult issues because of not getting one big mass of funding from one union. So I don't know what the future holds, but as most of you, I think, probably know, our times is now closing after 42 years. And again, while I say the labor movement, you know, supported our times, it was fantastic. But in the end, even I guess we couldn't face the final crunch, basically. But I figure 40 years of publishing stories about workers' rights and social justice isn't too damn bad.
Thank you, Lorraine. And just on a personal note, I always thought that every single issue of our times was a quality issue. And that speaks to your work and everyone else involved. So thank you for all those amazing issues, that amazing content.
Thanks for joining us today for Local 3's podcast, Breaking Ground, where we discuss all things labor, labor history, politics, and organizing as it relates to Operating Engineers Local 3. And we're really happy to have on the show with us today the International Union of Operating Engineers Political and Legislative Director Jeffrey Soth, as well as our political director, Chris Snyder, who we interviewed in the previous podcast. Can you talk a little bit about what the current administration has done in terms of these core values for us, and maybe compare that to the previous administration insofar as the main things that our union members need?
Well, most of my time is spent advocating for job creation. We do some extensive work on prevailing wages and protecting Davis-Bacon and key labor standards as well. But most of my time is spent trying to make investments in rebuilding America. And after decades of work on that, at really all levels of my career, even going back to when I was an elected official in the 90s, plugged into trying to rebuild this country and advocating for operating engineers for, gosh, I'm about 17 years now at the International. Boy, we spent an awful lot of time, energy, and money trying to get a big infrastructure package over the finish line, and been working in that direction for decades. And in 2021, finally accomplished that with the Biden administration. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act passed in the fall of 2021. And within it was the five-year highway and transportation, highway and transit reauthorization, which is always a critical priority for us. But beyond that, extensive investments made in sewer and water systems, in the energy grid, in airports, in rail, you name it, and really was a heck of an achievement for us, and has led to the record growth that we have seen in the construction industry. We're at an all-time record in American construction right now. 8,162,000 workers employed in the industry, And what's even better for operating engineers is those key segments of our markets in heavy and civil engineering, highway, street, and bridge construction in particular, are also at all-time records and driving our growth. And that's led to record growth for the union as well. We're about 408,000 members actually right now, and that's our record here since we were created in 1896 and been around for a long time. So we're at record levels and want to keep that going.
You mentioned the $3.7 billion dedicated to high-speed rail. This year, we also received a big award for the Humboldt Bay Offshore Wind. Do you want to talk a little bit about that project?
Either one of you. That's one of the most exciting projects, because we can walk and chew gum at the same time. You know, we're always protecting our core industries within the oil and gas and highway and energy production. But there's these new new investments, record investments in the Inflation Reduction Act and in the Jobs Act that Jeff mentioned, investing in the energy of the future. And offshore wind is a huge part of that. And a huge part of that is in Humboldt Bay. And it's kind of mind blowing what they're doing, because Humboldt Bay is the last undeveloped deep water port. And they're going to build, we got a $27 million grant to build basically a giant heavy lift station that's going to basically put together these giant windmills that are 700 feet tall and 150 feet wide. And they want to float them out and build one every 10 days when they start getting going by 2030, 2035, and build hundreds and hundreds of them over the next, 15 to 20 years. It's really amazing what they're trying to do. And it's new technology, and they're going to float them off 25 miles offshore. It's over 1,000 feet deep where these things are going to be.
What that means for our members there specifically is that there's been very little job opportunities in Humboldt County. I mean, all of our members there have to travel hundreds of miles to find work, and it's literally going to put them on the map. I mean, people are going to come there to find jobs, which is very unusual at this time.
No, it's transformative. I mean, since the timber kind of fell apart in the 50s and 60s, and then, they had a very large underground economy in marijuana. Legalization of marijuana also collapsed the economy up there. So they're one of the poorer areas within the state. And this is, it's a transformative opportunity. We're working with Cal State Humboldt. We're working with local pre-apprenticeship programs to onboard folks in the community, working with the tribes up there. And I really believe that we're creating an ecosystem of offshore wind there, and it's going to be kind of the hub of the entire West Coast. It's just, it's really exciting stuff.
Welcome to another episode of OEA Grow. Today we're speaking with rural educators, and we have Jessica today. Jessica, can you please introduce yourself and tell us what your position is?
Sure. I'm Jessica Breidinger, and I am a social science instructor at Treasure Valley Community College in Ontario, Oregon. I've been teaching at TVCC for, 16 years now. I started with the college in disability services and did some adjunct teaching, and then moved into a full-time position shortly after that. So I've been with the college for about 17 years, teaching full-time, just a little bit less than that.
Can you describe the rural community college experience to our listeners?
It's an intense experience. It is an intense experience. One of the things that we say at rural institutions quite often is we wear many hats, especially in rural areas where we have some experience of poverty, economic downturn, that sort of thing. Resources are scarce and limited, and people are a resource. And so often we, what we find is that we wear a lot of hats.
I love that. I teach at a two-room schoolhouse, and so I completely understand the rural education experience, but it seems like whether you're a kindergarten teacher or a college professor in a rural setting, it's the many hats.
It is. And often people think of this idyllic, very bucolic kind of experience in the country, which there's a lot of that, right? But there's also that level of intensity when you are responsible for many of the social requisites that your students need, right? It's not like we have a million resources to offer students. Often it's us.
What is one event that really stands out to you in your years as a rural community college teacher?
So I had a student who I was working closely with in my capacity of a disability services. And the student experienced autism. I think we call that neurodiversity now as well, but these are things right back then, 15 years ago. We have a horse production program at our institution. And this student's goal was to learn how to break and train horses. And the student was rather frail, suffered some additional kind of physical ailments and health conditions. Our instructor was initially scared to death that the student was going to get trampled in the arena by the horses. There were some milestones and goals that we had to set for the student that were additional challenges beyond what other students experienced. So for instance, this was a tough cookie. So this student would mount up, you know, put the saddle on and you know, pull the cinch strap and do all the things that the other students do and would be riding along with the horse, and the saddle would just kind of slip sideways and the student would end up underneath the horse. And, you know, the instructor was kind of, I don't know what we're going to do. You know, they can't.
That's dangerous.
Yeah, this is dangerous. What are the risks here? The student wanted to proceed and would just shake it off. And, you know, and it was very matter of fact about, you know, the singular purpose of this goal. We had to add some added goals in there and get some supplemental instruction and develop some methods for this student to learn to properly cinch up the belly, I guess, and I'm not even familiar with, you know, horsemanship terms, but, you know, the belly cinch on the horse so that the saddle was solid and would not move around. All the other students, that was not an issue, right? That was something that they had already learned to do. So it took a little bit longer. The student was with us, you know, maybe longer than the instructor had hoped, but was certainly longer. And the student made successful academic progress and graduated with their self-stated goals and declared degree. So it was glorious. It was nail-biting, hair-pulling, harrowing times, and a lot of conversations, a lot of tears from the student. I had an experience one time where the student was just completely overwhelmed, burst through my doors. I was not in my office, burst through my doors. And my secretary said, "You have a student crouching underneath your desk. I just want to warn you when you go in." So just having an emotional meltdown, because not because of these things that were happening, but because people were telling them that maybe possibly, you know, are not going to make it through. And that was what the meltdown was about, because the student was just relentless in pursuit of goals. And you know, that reminds me of how persistence is such an important ingredient. Being gritty and being persistent is such an important ingredient in success for students. And this student is my number one kind of, you know, flashbulb memory about what it means to be gritty and really go after what you want.
And that is going to do it for this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. just a small sample of the amazing programs aired over the last week on more than 200 labor radio and podcast shows. They're all part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, shows that focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org. You can also find them. Use the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And don't forget, grab your Labor Radio Podcast Network t-shirt now, available on our website, laborradionetwork.org. This podcast is recorded under a SAG-AFTRA collective bargaining agreement. The Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited this week by Patrick Dixon. I produce the show, and our social media guru, as always, is Mr. Harold Phillips. For the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. See you next week.